For several weeks now, I've been trying to pull out major events from the life of Christ, retell them, and in so doing help to put together the story of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection for us afresh. We started with his birth, boyhood, the work in the carpenter's shop, his baptism, proceeded with his temptation, his work as a teacher, and we looked at the reasons people opposed him. Last Sunday morning, we pulled out the last week of his life and noted that if we put the Gospels together, we get events from each of the days. On Sunday, he went into Jerusalem in what we call the triumphal entry, went into the temple, looked around over it, turned and walked out. Went home to Bethany, a suburban town 2 miles out of the city of Jerusalem, where he was staying overnight. Came back in on Monday and cleansed the temple. Drove out the money changers and those who had doves and other animals for sacrifices for the pilgrims who'd come to Jerusalem. That night, when he returned to Bethany, a good bit of opposition was stirring against him. When he came back on Tuesday, he was immediately asked about his authority in doing all these things, and that opened up a series of controversies with the leading groups of the Jewish people. On Wednesday, he didn't come into the city. He stayed back in Bethany and had a meal at the house of Simon the leper, and the woman came and broke her alabaster box of ointment and poured it over his head. On Thursday, he didn't come into the city until late in the day, but after the evening 6 o'clock period, when Friday would have begun, the Passover feast was prepared and eaten. And then Thursday evening, we left him in the upper room where he had instituted the Lord's Supper at the close of that Passover feast. Goodspeed says, he taught New Testament studies at the University of Chicago for a long time and made one of the first modern speech translations of the Bible. Goodspeed says that Jesus left that upstairs room and started back toward Bethany to spend the night again. I don't know whether Jesus intended to go back to Bethany to spend the night or not. He had terrible premonitions in that room. He knew that the hour was drawing very near. I don't know how much he knew about the exact moment when the hour would come. But he'd already told Judas to go out into the night and do what he was doing and do it quickly. But Jesus did leave that upstairs room and start toward Bethany in the same way he'd gone out every night to go back to his hometown, the town he was making a hometown, the edge of Jerusalem, and spend the night. But on the side of the Mount of Olives, instead of continuing his journey to Bethany, he stopped in a garden called Gethsemane. It means oil press. If you were a tourist in Palestine today, the guides would show you huge, scrawny, old olive trees that, with their hugeness and yet their signs of age all around, the guide would say are probably 1,900, 2,000 years old. More careful students would say they're probably as old as 1,000 years. But at any rate, it was under trees like that, in a place very near there, if not in that exact spot, that Jesus stopped and left 8 of his disciples at the gate of the garden and went inside. He wanted to be alone, and yet he wanted his 3 companions, Peter, James, and John, near. So he took them a little closer with him, a little farther. And then he left them and said, "Watch." My heart is almost breaking. "You must watch with me for a while." He went away and he prayed to the Father, "Father, anything is possible with you. If it's possible, let this cup pass from me. And yet, not as I will, but as you will." That's not all he prayed. We're not to think that that's the entire length of the prayer, that his praying it would take no longer than my reciting it. But Jesus came back and found Peter, James, and John asleep. One of the Gospels says their eyes were very heavy. And he said, "Couldn't you watch with me 1 hour? The spirit indeed is willing. Human nature is weak." He left and went back a second time, prayed the same words, falling on the ground again. And he came back a second time and found them asleep. He awakened them. "Couldn't you watch with me? Watch and pray." He went back a third time, prayed the same thing, and came back this time saying, "Arise, the betrayer is at hand." When the disciples got up, sure enough, they saw a band of people coming, the temple police. They're not called that in the Gospels. They're just called the chief priests and the officers with them. But along with the temple police, the Roman police, the soldiers, coming out, according to John 19:4, with weapons as well as lanterns and torches. The word John uses is a word which means prepared for battle. That is, it describes the kind of equipment the soldier would take when he goes out to fight in a battle. They come with swords and staves and clubs, the other gospel records say. I don't know what they were expecting. Had somebody told them that Jesus was really dangerous, that he was a messianic king, a guerrilla warfare leader? Had they really indicated that his followers were dangerous? One thing is for sure. Judas had said, "I'll go right up to him and kiss him." That wasn't too unusual for a man to greet his friend in such a way. But Judas had said, "I'll mark him out." And as they approached Jesus, Jesus said, "Whom do you seek?" They were evidently expecting him either to fight or to flee or to hide. The disciples did have a couple of swords. Simon Peter whipped one of them out and started using it. Jesus healed a man he had cut, told him to put it away. "All who take the sword shall perish with the sword." And then Jesus wanted to know, "Whom do you seek?" They were so overwhelmed by his offering himself voluntarily. They said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he said, "I am he." And they fell back to the ground in awe. When they had recovered their composure, he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." He said, "Then let these men go. Let my disciples go free." And they led him away for the trial. The Mishnah, which I mentioned before, which was put together in the 3rd century A.D., and the Talmud, which dates from earlier than that, commentaries on Jewish tradition, tell us what an ideal trial should have been like in the Jewish nation in that day. An ideal trial would start with making sure the prisoner, the accused, was given a fair trial in every way. If there's nobody present to defend him, appoint a defender. If there's nothing to be found in his favor, find something to say in his favor. Give him a proper trial, a fair trial. And then witnesses were to be brought together for their testimony. Deuteronomy 19, verse 6 says that no man shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness, that by the testimony of two or three witnesses, a man may be put to death. The witnesses could not be relatives, neither could they be enemies or friends. Their testimony had to agree, and when a man was accused of a capital crime and the sentence was passed, the witnesses were brought back again at the end of the trial to cast the first stones at him. The trial should be conducted in the proper place. That was in the hall of the hewn rock, the place in the temple area where the high priest made his general quarters. And the gates to that temple were locked overnight. The quorum was to be there. In Numbers 11 chapter, Moses, according to God's command, had chosen 70 leaders of Israel, 70 elders, to serve as a leading body. And they were presided over by the high priest. That's called the Sanhedrin. And that 70-member body had to be represented by at least 23 judges in that trial if capital punishment were going to be passed. There had to be a quorum. If they should pronounce the man innocent, a majority vote of one was enough to carry it. If they pronounced him guilty and worthy of death, it required a majority vote of two. If he were innocent, they could pronounce the verdict the same day and carry it out, set him free. If he were guilty, they had to delay overnight for the pronunciation of the verdict before putting him to death. There were all sorts of safeguards to try to be sure the man was given a fair trial. If he was pronounced guilty, that could be changed as a verdict to innocent. But if it was pronounced innocent, he could not be changed to a verdict of guilty. There had to be the protection of the witness. And finally, those of us who grew up in a country where English common law has spilled over into our legal system and a man is judged to be innocent until he's proved guilty, appreciate that fact. But the Sanhedrin had other of our rules, too. We call it the Fifth Amendment. Their rules said that no man could be put to death on his own testimony. That's the way a trial should go. When this trial proceeds, it goes to Annas and Caiaphas for a religious trial, then the whole Sanhedrin. Then Jesus is taken away to Herod. He sends him to Pilate. He sends him to Herod. Herod sends him back to Pilate. And there are three things that are standouts in the trial. One is the search for witnesses. We've got to have something to say when we take him to the governor. We've got to have a charge that will stick. The charge before the high priest was blasphemy. That's the second thing that stands out. He says he's the Son of God. But when he goes before the Roman governor, that may be made as a charge. It was in John 19:7. But it won't stick by itself. We've got to have something else. And so they said, "If you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. For he who makes himself a king is not Caesar's friend." Luke 23:2. The charge, treason. Well, that's what an ideal trial should have been like, and that's basically the steps through which the trial went, and that's what came up against Jesus, the charges of blasphemy and treason. But let's look at the trial in a little more detail. He was taken first to Annas after the arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane. Annas is called father-in-law to Caiaphas, who was high priest that same year. You know that ordinarily in the Old Testament, when a man was appointed high priest, he was high priest for life. But Rome had taken over Palestine. The Jews no longer had their independence. And I've told you earlier that from 37 B.C. to 67 A.D., there were no fewer than 28 high priests. The immediate predecessor of Pontius Pilate as governor of Judea had dismissed and confirmed others four straight times in the high priesthood. So being a high priest was not a very secure office in those days. And Annas was a former high priest. That's why we have the chief priests. We have some of these retired high priests. But Annas being the first man, he asks Jesus, according to the Gospels, about his disciples and about his teaching. I don't know what all of that means, but there were secret groups in Palestine in that day with secret membership lists and secret beliefs. And the implications are that Annas thought that Jesus was such a leader that he probably had a much larger following than we see any evidence of, that his teachings are secret. If we could bring it all out in the open, we could get rid of this man who's troubling Israel. You know Jesus' answer? I taught daily in the synagogues and in the temple. Ask them what I taught. He refused to defend himself or to explain his teachings to the former high priest. He simply says, you ask anybody you want who has heard me. My teachings have been open. I've done nothing in secret. And they led him away to Caiaphas. That's where the proper trial should have been had. But it isn't a proper trial. In the first place, they don't appoint anyone to defend Jesus. They don't look for anything defensible in him. He isn't given the benefit of being the accused on the receiving end of a capital punishment charge. There's no attempt to give him fairness. In the second place, the witnesses would be brought. They were brought, all right. They made their charges, the charges of blasphemy. But on what grounds? Well, he had said that he forgave sins. Maybe that was the ground. He was often charged with breaking the Sabbath. Sometimes he would say, think not that I've come to destroy the law. I came not to destroy it, but to fulfill it. That defensiveness indicates that somebody was charging that he had destroyed the law. Tertullian, writing about 200 A.D. in North Africa, says the first of the list of charges was Sabbath destroyer. I'm not sure Tertullian knew any more about it than we do, but that's one of the grounds on which they could have charged him with blasphemy. But the main ground that comes out in the Gospels and the trial itself is this man has spoken against the temple. That's what they stoned Stephen to death for later, remember? He's spoken against the temple. What's the charge? He says, I will destroy this temple, and after 3 days I'll build it again without hands. You have to read the second chapter of the Gospel of John to find where that charge came from. Jesus cleansed the temple, and when there was controversy, he said, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up again. He was talking about the temple of his own body. But they took this and thought he was speaking against that temple, and they said it took 46 years to build that temple. You mean if we destroy it, you can build it back in 3 days and without the use of any hands? It was blasphemy to them. He's claiming miraculous power, and he's going to destroy God's place. Jesus hadn't said, I will destroy this temple. Those are their words. He had said, you destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll build it up again. So the witnesses were not fair. They couldn't even agree on their testimony. The trial collapsed. It should have fallen completely apart, but it didn't. The place where the trial was held was not the right place. It was in the high priest's house. It wasn't in the temple precincts. The reason is that the gates of the temple were locked by night. No one could get there at the time they were conducting a trial. They were keeping a man up all night, using some sort of judicial procedure to give them the right to commit murder on the following day. It wasn't in the right place. The quorum? They may have had a quorum. We aren't told how many they had. They later had to convene the whole Sanhedrin to put the stamp of approval on the verdict. But the indications about the quorum are that when the witness's testimony fell apart, and it looked like the trial was going to fail because there was no way of finding two men who'd say the same thing against him, Caiaphas stood up. You have to read the Gospels carefully to note the tension, the drama of what really goes on. Have you ever seen a judge stand up in the middle of a trial and demand that a certain charge be answered by himself, not by the defense attorney or the prosecuting attorney? It is a tense moment. Caiaphas stands up and says, tell me, I adjure you, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? They were very hesitant to pronounce the name of God. But the other Gospels note that eventually Caiaphas is willing. Are you the Christ, the Son of God? And Jesus says the words. In Hebrew, Anihu. Isaiah 43, I am. Over and over in Isaiah 43, the language was used of God. It was used in festival after festival. You remember the burning bush. Tell them, I am that I am sent you. It was God's special name. When Jesus in John 8:58 said, before Abraham was, I am, they took up stones to stone him. And now he stands before Caiaphas. And Caiaphas says, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Standing. And Jesus says, I am. And then Caiaphas says, what further need do we have of witnesses? We don't need to examine the past anymore. We've heard it with our own ears. Why bring up what he did 2 years, 3 years ago? We've heard him say the words. He claims to be deity. He deserves, what do you think? And they said he deserves to die. From the youngest to the eldest, the roll should have been pulled. And the verdict was clear from every man. Death, death, from all indications. I can't imagine Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea sitting through that procedure. But the cry came for death. But then Luke tells us in Luke 22, verse 66, that when it was day, they brought together the council of chief priests and elders. The whole Sanhedrin had to be convened. And there was a quick mock trial to put the stamp of approval on what had been done during the wee hours of the night. And quickly they were away to Pontius Pilate's hall. I imagine it was a bit irritating to Pilate to have them barge in on his morning schedule at such an early hour with a prisoner and demand that he be tried. But Pilate was one to please the people whenever possible. So he began to hear the charges. What has he done? And when they said, he makes himself the Son of God, Pilate said, take him, judge him by your law. You have a law. They said, we can't put him to death. In AD 30, the Roman government had taken away the power of the Sanhedrin to enforce the death penalty. They could pass it, but they had to pass the man on to the civil power to get an approval before he could actually be put to death. And so they said, if you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. Treason is now introduced. And Luke 23, verses 2 through 4, he has spread this teaching all the way from Galilee to Judea. When Pilate heard that word Galilee, he said, is he a Galilean? And when they said he was, he said, Herod is in the city today. Take him to Herod. Let him judge him. He's ruler of Galilee. And so they took Jesus away to Herod. There must have been some nervousness in the Sanhedrin. The Gospels say that Herod heard John the Baptist gladly, although he later put him to death, and that he had longed to hear Jesus and to see him, hoping he would see some miracle performed by him. They led Jesus into Herod's presence with the Sanhedrin, afraid, no doubt, that Herod might be so anxious to hear him that he'd set him free after hearing him. And Herod began to ask him questions about his teachings, about his disciples, and Jesus would not answer a word. He knew the kind of man he was addressing or standing before. He'd called him a fox on another occasion. He knew how Herod would hound his life if he had any possible reason, and so he stood silently. And finally, Herod had his soldiers put their purplish robes, such as they wore on him, and a crown of thorns, which they plaited and forced down on his head. And with a bit of other mockery, he sent him back to Pontius Pilate. Pilate and Herod made friends during that time. They'd formerly been alienated from each other. But Pilate has the problem on his hands again. Pilate has tried one alternative to save an innocent man. He sent him to Herod. He heard a few more charges. He talked with Jesus privately. Are you a king? Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. You've said it. I am a king. I came into the world to bear witness to the truth. But I'm no threat to Caesar. That's the clear implication. Pilate could see it all. Pilate knew that for envy they delivered him, Matthew says in chapter 27. So Pilate went out and said, you know, we have a practice. I'd call it Passover amnesty. Every year at this feast, I always let one man go free. Now I'm going to set a prisoner free this morning. Who is it going to be? You must choose, Barabbas or Jesus will go free. Barabbas was a notorious robber. He had committed murder in an insurrection. If you had to translate that into current language, you'd have to say he was a leader of guerrilla warfare. Do you want him set loose among the people again, or do you want Jesus turned free? Agitators went through the crowds and moved the people, and they began to say, release Barabbas. What then shall I do with Jesus, who's called the Christ? Crucified. Why? What evil has he done? Three times Pilate asked it. Why? What evil has he done? But when they would not listen to reason, Pilate tried a third alternative. He said, I will scourge him and release him. The scourge was a whip which had three cords. At the end of the whip would be sharp bits of bone or metal or stone. When the Jewish people administered it, they let it fall across the bare back of the person 13 times. That made 39 stripes. The law forbade giving a man more than 40 stripes. That's why Paul says he had received 39 stripes, or 40 stripes save one, on several occasions. When the Romans administered it, the number of stripes was left to the whim of the administrator. And a good many men, by our best records, left the scourge either raving mad, or having fainted under its pressure and the loss of blood, or even dying under the scourge. And so Pilate took Jesus and had him scourged. I've never seen a man treated that way. But to bring a man out, bleeding, his back bare, the mock crown on his head, who's done nothing wrong,
And to say, as Pilate said, "Behold the man." If there's any softness in the heart of anyone there, surely that's enough. Pilate tried, but it wasn't enough. And they clamored for his death. And finally, Pilate called for a basin of water. And he washed his hands and said, "My hands are free from the blood of this innocent man." And they pronounced the curse. "His blood be on us and on our children forever." And they led him away to crucify him. That's the trial. It was a mock trial. It violated all procedures of the Sanhedrin. The governor himself knew Jesus should have been set free. Governor from 26 to 36 A.D., he wasn't always popular with the people. He didn't want to pronounce a death sentence that somebody else might revoke, nor did he want to displease the people that much. And so a man with no backbone, no spine, knowing what was right, but knowing what people wanted against the right, said, "Behold a man," and allowed him to go to be crucified. But it can't be all ancient history. It's here to tell us that he who said, "Love your enemies," that he who taught humility and meekness was able to practice it under the most trying circumstances. It's here to tell us that there's a quality of life to be reproduced in every one of our lives. He was crucified because of a bunch of gossip. And yet it's so easy for us to prejudge people and to say malicious things about them. The irony of it all, they're sitting in judgment on Jesus when one day he'll sit in judgment on us all. And yet that's what happened. And from it emerges the appeal to live the quality of life he lived, even under such strain as that. It takes a great deal of courage in our time to say, "I'm going to live that kind of life. I'm going to live it no matter what the challenges." But there are people who have said it. And if you haven't, I hope you will while we sing. Thank you.